Hello and welcome to our weekly podcast of Who's Here in the Hamptons. I'm Dan Rettiner, your host, broadcasting from my home in the Hamptons, where I have lived for over 55 years. I've written a dozen books about this glorious place, and I've seen it grow through the years from small tourist towns, quaint fishing villages, and a summer playground for high society, to what it is today, a world-class resort for celebrities, artists, musicians, authors, and billionaires. In my podcast, I will bring you interviews with not only these people, but also prominent local people who have helped shape the Hamptons. Welcome to Dan's Talks. My guest today is Pam Koloff, a writer at large at the New York Times Magazine, and I should confess to you all that I know her because I've been friends with her mother for 20 years. And I went to her wedding in Austin. And so here we are again. And she has been nominated for 6 National Magazine Awards, one of which she won. She's been given the Harvard Nieman Foundations for Journalism Award. She's a celebrated writer, an excellent one, who writes largely about investigative work. I guess we can start by my asking you tell me, how did you get interested in becoming a journalist? How did that start out?
Thank you so much for having me. I have always been a very overly curious person. And when I realized in high school that if you called yourself a reporter, that you then had the right to ask anybody pretty much anything and to invite yourself into their lives, no questions asked, that was very appealing to me.
Detective or a cop.
Exactly. I've also just always been a great reader and love stories, and I enjoy getting to meet different people. And to me, there's no job that's more fun than this. I think you would agree, where you can just explore so many different subjects and meet so many different kinds of people.
You're well known for writing many stories about people who've been convicted of crimes that they never committed. A good question to ask you is, how many of them resulted in activity that led to their release?
That's a great question. There have been so many different outcomes in each of these cases, but the one that really set me on this path was a case I wrote about in 2010 of a man named Anthony Graves. I'm based in Texas, grew up in New York, but based in Texas. And Anthony had been wrongly convicted of a murder and had landed on Texas's death row. And very, very long story short, I did an investigative piece about his case and the charges against him at the time he was awaiting retrial were ultimately dropped and he was exonerated. And it showed, my work was based on a tremendous amount of digging by one very dogged attorney named Nicole Caceres. What I brought to the table was storytelling so that people could understand the very complex legal issues and facts at stake there. And the combination helped Anthony greatly. And so I think that was the beginning of being interested in all this. And then there have been different outcomes along the way. Sometimes nothing happens. Most recently, someone I wrote about was granted parole. He was not exonerated after he'd been denied parole 7 times, which is still a life-changing outcome, if not perfect.
How many of altogether have you written? A dozen?
Probably about a dozen for the in-depth investigations, yes.
And in 2010, had you already started out being a reporter somewhere?
Yes. So I started out, I grew up in New York. I ended up here in Austin. I worked at Texas Monthly for 20 years, which is a terrific regional magazine that does incredible criminal justice reporting. And so I got to learn about every aspect of the criminal justice system writing for them. doing everything from going to hearings to I did cover an execution and wrote about the death penalty here a great deal. And then in 2017, I joined the New York Times Magazine and ProPublica. I jointly work for both.
How does that play out? What is there an advantage to being at both of them instead of one or the other?
I think so. And I, you know, I'm very, very lucky. They created a partnership for me out of the two news organizations. And so if you think about what each of those places, what they do, what their mandates are, if you put them together, basically what my job is to write about stories that have tremendous public interest focus and that can have some kind of impact, perhaps, while also sort of employing the narrative storytelling skills that the Times likes to have in the magazine. And to me, the combination of those two things is like the sweet spot of investigative journalism.
What are those? How are they different and how do they help each other?
Well, I think traditionally, before I came to this job, sometimes I just did narratives. I just did stories that were interesting or that had fascinating people at their center. And I still love those stories and sometimes miss those stories. But I think going into a piece, knowing that you are trying to address sort of larger wrongs and that you are trying, it's such an incredible platform. If you think about the combined readership of the New York Times and ProPublica, it's not something to squander. And so, you know, what are the most important issues to be shining a spotlight on and to get people thinking about, and how can it maybe change the conversation around certain issues?
Well, my question was how do they, what are the different things that each of them provide different from the other?
I didn't answer that, so I'm going to do a better job. I think storytelling enhances public interest journalism.
Yes, it
does. In the following way, you can have the most important issue imaginable, but if you don't tell it in an engaging way, if you don't have readers make that emotional connection, if you don't get them invested with story and character, they're not going to read it or they're not going to care as much. And I think similarly, having that bar to meet for a narrative, that there has to be a larger purpose and a deeper meaning to the story, makes the narrative resonate more.
You spend some of your time out here in the Hamptons, where we are. What do you like about the Hamptons, besides that your mom's here?
I love it so much. I usually get to spend a week out there every summer. And the entire time I'm out there, I'm thinking, why do I not spend all of my time here? So much of my time is rooted here in Texas because of my kids and work. But to me, Southampton, where my mother is just such a peaceful, beautiful place. And when I go to the beach there, I can sort of think and take in things in this whole new way that I can't when I'm so focused on the nitty-gritty day-to-day stuff like I am here. It's just, I think, one of the most beautiful places I've ever been.
I feel the same way about it. That's why I stayed. What are you currently working on, if you can tell me?
Oh, absolutely. So I just finished a piece that was a cover story in the Times Magazine, and it was about a wrongful conviction that happened in Nashville, Tennessee, more than two decades ago. And it involved a father who was wrongly convicted of killing his child. It's a very intense story. And his conviction was based on a diagnosis of what's called shaken baby syndrome. This is a diagnosis that has been called into question in recent years. And without getting too far down the road of that, the quick version is that these symptoms that are the hallmarks of shaken baby syndrome used to always be taken as evidence of abuse. And we now know that there are many other medical explanations for those symptoms. but there's still many, many, many people locked up because of those convictions. And what drew me to Nashville is the DA's office there has a very interesting unit there called the Conviction Review Unit. And what they do is they look at convictions that their own prosecutors prosecuted, where there are questions of innocence because of changing science or new evidence. And then they go back, they reinvestigate those cases. And if they find there's evidence of innocence, they go before a judge to argue that this defendant was wrongly convicted. And I just thought that idea was so fascinating that a DA's office would investigate itself. And this particular unit had had a lot of success, so I followed them. So in answer to your question, I'm sorry for the long lead up. I just published that, and now I'm doing some follow-up stories on shaken baby syndrome and present-day prosecutions.
What you do sounds like the truthful version of books by John Connolly or John Grisham, who make up wrongful correction. Connolly in particular writes all the time about convictions and crimes committed 20, 30 years ago that he's reinvestigating in the cold case. It's very impactful to read about and know it's actually happening.
Yes, and to that point, John Grisham has a book coming out this fall that's actually entirely about wrongful convictions in Texas. It's a nonfiction book, but I think the sort of intersection between some of these big fiction writers and what's happening on the ground is, you know, becoming more evident. And it is shocking. I've been working on a book now for a couple of years. I'm very close to the end. That is a work of nonfiction about a wrongful conviction in Florida, but it's so unbelievable, and it's such a twisty plot that it's almost hard to believe it's true. And I just made the decision at the end to come in and use the first person as a way to resolve the book, because I wanted to remind people this is real. This is something that's happening right now. This person's sitting on death row in Florida right now.
Have there been occasions when you've actually saved a man's life by having written about it?
I have not. Certainly attorneys have that I've written about. And, you know, I come from a family of lawyers, but never went to law school myself. And I have so much respect for the lawyers who fight these fights. These are, you almost always lose. You never make any money doing this. And it's heartbreaking work. And the people here who do this type of post-conviction work, you know, just the toll that it takes on them is intense. And I've spoken to many lawyers, you know, especially those with capital cases who've lost clients who they believed were innocent, or at least their convictions had deep problems, who were executed. We had, until recently, a very active death chamber in Texas.
Well, my question was there anyone who was on death row and would have been executed had it not been what you wrote?
I can't take credit for that.
It's true. There could be several, many reasons why.
Well, and you know, sometimes it's not a matter of, I'll give you an example. There's a case I wrote about many years ago of a man named Michael Morton here in Texas, who was wrongly convicted and later exonerated. He was wrongly convicted of murdering his wife. DNA evidence was later tested that connected it to another perpetrator who's now behind bars. Michael was already out of prison when I started writing about his case, but I ended up writing this 26,000 opus about his case. And it focused on the fact that prosecutors had withheld exculpatory evidence and that by doing so, it had cost this man 25 years. After that story came out, and after there was a lot of other media coverage about Michael's case, the law was changed here in Texas so that prosecutors must turn over all evidence to the defense. It's what's called having an open file policy. And that was something that came out of Michael's case. And I think having that kind of scrutiny on his case certainly helped. So to me, that's the stuff that's the lasting change, is legislative changes and things that affect more than one person.
Tell me about some articles you've written that are different or not your usual targets, or I guess that's the wrong word, or discoveries. Can you think of a few?
So many. So I just talked about a lot of dark and depressing stories, but there were so many. When I was at Texas Monthly, really my job was to go all over the state and write about different interesting things that people were doing. So I wrote about a rodeo queen competition. I wrote about a teen beauty pageant. I just had so many different adventures. Probably the most fun thing I ever did for Texas Monthly was every year we would do, or every 5 years, I should say, we would do a special issue, a barbecue issue, the best barbecue in Texas. And I would have the difficult job, along with all my fellow colleagues, of crisscrossing the state to find the very best barbecue and getting to expense all of my meals along the way. And that was the best.
Yes, there's a well-known work, a musical work about a barbecue contest. I'm trying to remember it though. I know what it was about. Steakless, it's called. It was about.
I don't know this, but I want to see it.
It's it says there's a guy named Steakless from Tennessee who can cook a steak like you've never had, and he goes to be challenged by the corporates who start steakhouses around Austin and elsewhere. And so it's just one of those rambling songs you'd hear.
It sounds really fun.
When we get off this, I'll see if I can find it and send it to you.
Well, and I'll add one more thing. I think another story I had a lot of fun with was when George W. Bush was president. You know, my office right now is a block from the governor's mansion and the legislature. It's a small town, even though Austin's a big city now. And so when George W. Bush became president, obviously that was something we covered a lot. So I ended up doing both a cover story for Texas Monthly and a piece for The New Yorker about Crawford, Texas, the town where George W. Bush had his ranch, and how his arrival there completely and utterly changed the town and also made the town sort of this hokey backdrop for his presidential ambitions, when, of course, it was a very real place with real problems. And that was a fascinating, you know, I camped out there for many months, got to know the people there, and really enjoyed my time there.
Well, thank you for being on the podcast. Our time is up.
Thank you so much, Dan. I'm so honored.
Oh, I am, because I've been reading your stuff because I wanted to see how you were going to do. And you certainly have hit it out of the park. That's what's happened.
Thank you so much.
So thank you for being on the podcast, and I'll talk to you soon.
Okay, bye-bye. Thank you so much, Dan. Bye-bye.